Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 20th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Leasing for Cedar Rapids Affordable Housing Project Starts Soon. The Heights is bringing vital housing to Wellington Heights. Rehabilitation work now is complete on a once-blighted building in Wellington Heights that the city of Cedar Rapids transformed into 25 affordable rental units, adding sorely needed housing stock for low-income residents and revitalizing a key corner of the core neighborhood. Tenants soon will have the chance to apply to move into that building at 1500 2nd Avenue Southeast, now dubbed the Heights, that the city will turn over to the Hawkeye Arena Community Action Program to own and operate. This property once housed the Colonial Center before the city in December 2021 purchased it, and it leveraged 4 grants to complete the approximately $7 million rehabilitation. With affordable housing in scarce supply, the project is a step toward meeting housing needs. In Iowa, the need for rental housing geared toward those earning up to 30% of the area median income is one of the greatest areas of demand. The state projects a shortage of 55,219 rental units serving that income bracket by 2030. An agreement to officially give the property to HACAP will come to the City Council in May. Housing Services Manager Sarah Buck said that HACAP anticipates that it will start taking applications from potential tenants May 7th. City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said completion of the project is a proud moment for the city. He acknowledged the city's partnership with the Wellington Heights Neighborhood Association in supporting the development. The association helped choose the name and revise the concept for the building's redevelopment from what initially was proposed to be a combined shelter and community space into rental units geared towards low-income households. It's gratifying to see this former office space, which stood vacant for so many years, turned into a vital development that addresses that need for housing in the city of Cedar Rapids, he said. Pomerantz said that this revitalizes a key corner of the historic Wellington Heights neighborhood. Cedar Rapids-based Emergent Architecture collaborated with the City Historic Preservation Commission to ensure the renovation was consistent with the history of the district, he said. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said the facility is a gateway into improving Wellington Heights, a neighborhood on the move. She pointed to other projects, including the Eastern Iowan Health Center's newly opened dental clinic and the location for the Permanent Boys and Girls Club of the Corridor facility at 1602 Washington Avenue Southeast. Every citizen in our community, regardless of background, where they come from, where they want to go, deserve a safe, affordable place where they can not only find refuge, but can find strength, and they can find resources to live their best lives, O'Donnell said. HACAP will provide supportive services and an employee will be on site at least 30 hours a week, Buck said. This facility would share an employee with another nearby HACAP property and use other funding sources to provide supportive services for tenants. Under terms of the city, HACAP will have low overall rent rates, with 15 of the 25 units renting to those at or below 50% of the area median income, those either experiencing or at risk of homelessness as required by some of the federal grants used. There are 10 units that are the other 10 units are for those earning 80% or less of the area median income. Buck said that HACAP already prioritizes individuals that are at risk of homelessness or homeless, which is what made the organization a good partner for this project. HACAP Board President John Branch said that this was one more way that HACAP is working to fulfill its mission of helping people to achieve success and build strong communities. All utilities costs are included in the rent because the building operates off 1 meter. The facility also offers a laundry room where the tenants won't be charged to wash their clothes, a community gathering room, a computer room, and storage space. Each unit is fully convertible, with those with disabilities and some already fully compliant with the American with Disabilities Act, with space underneath kitchen appliances for wheelchairs, lower height counters, and other features. Among the units earmarked for the lowest incomes, rent for 2-bedroom is $800 a month, Buck said. For anyone above 30% of the area median income, monthly rent for a 1-bedroom is $650. People earning less would pay lower rents for a 1-bedroom unit. Cedar Rapids put in place a 15-year affordability requirement for the property, enforced through a lien. We are just elated to be part of this investment in the community. The investment is not just in the stick build, but also in the lives of individuals who are going to be the residents of the Heights, because their lives are going to be enhanced and their contribution to this community can continue. When they feel seen, said Ulysses Claiborne, the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department Regional Administrator. Now let's move on to the article, Lawsuit, USDA Can't Deny Benefits for Farming in a Wetland. The Gazette, a Philadelphia investor who bought a Northeast Iowa farm in 2022, is now suing the U.S. Department of Agriculture because he can't get subsidies if he plants crops in a wetland. The case filed Tuesday in U.S. District Court challenges one of the only remaining protections for wetlands, which filter agricultural runoff and provide wildlife habitat after a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that stripped federal safeguards for many wetlands. CTM Holdings, represented by libertarian law firm Pacific Legal Foundation, argues the USDA is violating the U.S. Constitution by making CTM owner James Conlan give up use of 9 acres of wetland in order to get government benefits, including Conservation Reserve Program payments and crop insurance for his renter. They are essentially saying, give us a conservation easement so you can't do anything in this land or we'll take away these benefits, Jeff McCoy, senior attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, told the Gazette. We feel like that is a taking. But unlike previous court cases cited in the lawsuit related to whether a developer could get a permit to build in a wetland, the Iowa lawsuit is about getting subsidies. We tend to give government a little more room when it's spending money. It's money, said Shannon Rosler, the Charlotte and Frederick Hubble Professor of Environmental and Natural Resources Law at the University of Iowa. Here's a subheader. Investor owns 1,000 Iowa acres. Through CTM Holdings, Conlan owns 1,075 acres of farmland in Delaware, Linn, Benton, and Johnson counties, according to the complaint filed in federal court. The lawsuit relates to a 71-acre parcel in Delaware County just north of Highway 20 and east of town of Delaware. Conlan, an Iowa native, lives in Philadelphia suburb Newtown Square and is the CEO of Legacy Liability Solutions, a Chicago firm that advises, acquires, and restructures companies after class action lawsuits or other major litigation. Like many investors, Conlan rents his own Iowa farmland. The tenant on the Delaware County parcels wants to plant corn and soybeans on the 9 acres the USDA in 2010 designated a wetland, the complaint states. The 9 acres of wetland do not contain standing water and are not visibly wet, the complaint says. All the wetland on the property are at least 1,000 feet away from the small seasonal stream and are not connected to any water body. The swamp buster provision of the Food Security Act of 1985 allows the Natural Resources Conservation Service to make wetland determinations and discourages farming on those wetlands by denying benefits to people who drain, level, or clear vegetation on them. But what has changed in the last year is a 2023 Supreme Court ruling that weakened Clean Water Act protections for wetlands. In Sackett v. EPA, the High Court said that wetlands must have a continuous connection to federally protected waters such as navigable streams, to be covered by the Clean Water Act. Sackett did make it clear what the federal government can regulate, McCoy said. If you can't regulate it directly, then you can't force someone to do it in exchange for benefit. Another subheader, benefits of wetlands. Rosler, the University of Iowa law professor, said the government does have the authority to regulate industry when it infringes on the rights of others. We recognize land development, including farming, imposes negative externalities on the neighbors in the watershed that government does have some role in recognizing, especially if the government is spending money to support agriculture, she said. The argument would be that they can attach conditions that minimize those externalities by way of preserving wetlands that provide a number of social benefits to the watershed. Wetlands provide flood control, water filtration, groundwater recharge, and habitat for wildlife, said Iowa State University Extension and Outreach reports. About one quarter of Iowa was once in some form of wetlands, ISU said. Nearly all of those areas are gone, with much of the land drained for row crop agriculture. Some areas are designated wetlands, may appear dry because of a multi-year drought in much of Iowa. The U.S. Drought Monitor on Thursday showed that much of northeast Iowa is still in an extreme to moderate drought. Now let's go on to some tax law. Latest Iowa income tax cuts move are likely to become law. Proposal would cut income taxes and state revenue by $1 billion in the first 2 years. A proposed new round of state income tax cuts would save Iowa's taxpaying workers nearly $1 billion in the first 2 years, and thus limit future state revenue by the same, according to a nonpartisan analysis published Friday. The proposed state income tax cuts were making their way through the lawmaking process Friday at the Iowa Capitol as legislators worked to conclude their work for the year. It would be the third time since 2018 that State House Republicans have led the charge to lower state income tax rates. Previous state income tax cuts were passed in 2018 and 2022. Those 2022 reductions, which were being phased in, would be accelerated under the latest proposal, which appears destined to become state law. If that happens, there would be two tax rates next year and just one in 2026, 3.9%. The state's nonpartisan legislative service agency has projected those cuts at full implementation in 2026 will reduce tax collections and state revenue by $1.9 billion annually. The new proposal would speed up that process and lower the flat tax rate to 3.8% next year. The Legislative Service Agency projected that acceleration would lower the state revenue and provide state income tax savings by an additional $328 million in the 2025 state and state budget year and $605 million in fiscal 2026. And roughly $100 million annually over each of the next four years, for a total of more than $1.3 billion over the next 6 years. The latest proposed reductions would be funded by the state's general fund surplus, which is just under $2 million, and the state's taxpayer relief fund, which is projected to have a balance of $3.7 billion at the close to the current state budget year. The proposal, Senate File 2442, was approved Friday morning by a bipartisan 31-7 vote in Iowa Senate, with seven Democrats joining all Republicans in support. It was expected to be passed later Friday in the House, just a day after it was introduced. Governor Kim Reynolds is expected to sign the proposed tax cuts into law. Here's a subheader that says GOP trifecta. During debate in the Senate, Iowa Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican from Council Bluffs, recalled previous tax reduction kicks started by State House Republicans since they took full control of the state lawmaking process, earning majorities in both chambers of the Iowa legislature and occupying the governor's office after the 2016 elections. Dawson said those tax cuts made Iowa's overall tax climate among the best in the country. This Republican trifecta will have transformed the Iowa tax code from one of the least competitive in the United States to something that will be one of the most competitive. I will put our record of what we have done in 8 years against any other state in the nation, Dawson said. The Republican trifecta has listened to Iowans. We want to reform more of the money back to you. We want to return more of the money back to you, and we are absolutely re-engineering this tax code for one of the most competitive in the United States, letting the entire nation know that Iowa is open for business, families can move here, and we will protect the hard-earned dollars that you make. Final subheader, tax credits next, question mark? State House Democrats have argued that the tax cuts have benefited the wealthiest Iowans more and sooner. This latest proposal, some of the Democrats said during debate Friday, will benefit what they described as working-class Iowans. Senator Nate Bolton, a Democrat from Des Moines, said during debate that he would like to see examination of the tax credits and exemptions to create a more fair tax system in Iowa, but also exposed his support for the proposed income tax reductions. Expressed his support for the proposed income tax rate reductions. Democrats are seeing clear in this tax proposal, and that it's for the first time dealing with tax policy, we are actually seeing working-class Iowans get a quicker step towards tax relief, and that is something important in this legislation, Bolton said. Yes, there is work to do here to make our tax system fairer, but this bill does not deliver a fair tax system. But at the end of the day, it does make a difference to working-class Iowans to get some of this relief sooner than later. The legislation also tweaks last year's property tax overhaul that limits revenue growth for cities and counties and allows county supervisors to decide whether to keep or disband county compensation boards. Let's continue on to the article. Iowa bill hiking fines for open meeting violations headed by Governor Kim Reynolds. Iowa public officials are on track to incur larger fines for violating Iowa's open meetings law under a bill lawmakers sent to Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' desk Thursday night. Several Iowa city and school boards have recently received public criticism, and some have been penalized for holding private meetings on matters that should have been discussed publicly. The bill, House File 2539, was introduced by Representative Gary Moore of Bettendorf in response to concerns that he had about Davenport's $1.6 million settlement agreement with the former city administrator without a public vote from the city council. The former city administrator without the two separation agreements with former Davenport city employees also were initially implemented without public votes. Senator Scott Webster, a Republican from Bettendorf, also received the agreements when the Senate passed the bill Thursday. This bill is about making sure that when city councils and city governments and county governments are having conversations, that those are done in open, not done in privacy of darkness or night, Webster said. The bill passed unanimously in the Senate and 87-6 in the House. It is eligible to be signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. Here's a subheader that says officials could be fined up to $2,500 for violating law. Iowa law requires most meetings of elected bodies and public boards and commissions be held in public, with some exceptions. The bill would hike maximum fine for a government official unknowingly violating the law from $500 to $2,500. If a person knowingly violates the law, they could be fined up to $12,500. If a public official proves any of the following, they would be exempt from the fine: that the official voted against the closed session, the official had good reason to believe facts that, if true, would have put the meeting in compliance with the law, the official reasonably relied on a decision of a court or formal opinion from the Public Information Board, the Attorney General, or the attorney for the government body, the fine for violating the law is paid to the state if the violation is done by a state body, or to the local government if done by a local government body. Current law directs a court to issue an order to remove public official from office if they violate open meetings law more than once in the same term. The new bill would require a court to remove a member from the office if they have ever had a previous violation of the law and violated a second time. The bill also tweaks the definition of a meeting under Iowa law. Current law states that a meeting is a public gathering of a majority of members of a body in which they discuss anything related to their policymaking duties. The bill notes that a gathering that includes a member of local government body that is hosted or organized by a political party, political candidate, or civic organization is not considered a public meeting. The Senate removed a portion in the House-passed bill that would have required trainings on Iowa's open meetings and open record laws. Moore said that he would have liked the training portion to remain in the bill, but he was happy with how it turned out. Frankly, if we can keep the House penalties and remove the elected officials, I think it's a huge step forward, he said. Webster said some small cities were concerned about the trainings, but he said that he was interested in reconsidering those changes next year. Smaller article. Teen arrested after Cedar Rapids police respond to hoax at Harding. A 13-year-old boy was arrested Friday after Cedar Rapids police responded to a swatting call at a Harding Middle School, according to authorities. The school's office and police department both received calls Friday about a possible shooting in the school, according to a police news release and a message the school sent to parents. The Cedar Rapids Police Department responded to our school and confirmed that it was a swatting call. Swatting calls are hoax phone calls from a person reporting a serious crime to officials, which results in an emergency response, the message states. The school at 4801 Gulf Street Northeast went into a soft lockdown when the police investigated the call and that all students and staff were safe. After ensuring there was no active threat, police officers investigated the source of the call and arrested a 13-year-old boy who faces charges of making false reports to law enforcement and of third-degree harassment. The name of the juvenile has not been released. Now let's move on to some national news. With jury set, Trump trial to start Monday. The final jurors were seated Friday in Donald Trump's hush money trial, and an appellate judge rejected the former president's latest bid to halt the case as a hectic day in court set the stage for an opening statements to begin Monday. The panel of New Yorkers who will decide the first criminal trial of former U.S. president took final shape after lawyers spent days quizzing dozens of potential jurors on whether they can impartially judge Trump in a city where he built his real estate empire before being elected in 2016. The trial thrusts Trump's legal problems into the heart of his hotly contested race against President Joe Biden, with Trump's opponent likely to seize an unflattering and salacious testimony to make the case that the presumptive Republican nominee is unfit to return as commander-in-chief. Trump, meanwhile, is using the prosecution as a political rallying cry, casting himself as a victim while juggling his dual role as criminal defendant and presidential candidate. Judge Juan Merchan said lawyers will present opening statements Monday morning before prosecutors begin laying out their case, alleging a scheme to cover up negative stories Trump feared would hurt his 2016 campaign. He has pleaded not guilty and says the stories were false. Despite the failures of repeated previous attempts to delay the trial, a Trump attorney was in appeals court hours after the jury was seated, arguing that Merchan rushed through the jury selection and that Trump cannot get a fair trial in Manhattan. To think an impartial jury could be found in that period of time, I would respectfully submit, is untenable, Attorney Chief Clifford Roberts said. Justice Marsha Michael denied the request just 5 minutes after a brief hearing. Back in the trial court, Merchan expressed frustrations as Trump's lawyers pressed to revisit a litany pretrial rulings. So at some point, you need to accept the court's rulings, Merchan said. There's nothing else to clarify. There's nothing else to re-argue. We're going to have opening statements on Monday morning. The trial is starting. Just after the jury was seated, emergency crews responded to a park outside the courthouse where a man had set himself on fire. The man took out pamphlets espousing conspiracy theories and spread them about the park before dousing himself in a flammable substance and setting himself aflame, officials said. He was in critical condition Friday afternoon. Trump spent has spent the week sitting in the courtroom as lawyers pressed potential jurors about their views about him. During breaks in the proceedings, he has railed against the case on social media or to TV cameras in the hallway, calling it a witch hunt. An international article. Israel-Iran play down apparent Israeli airstrikes. Israel and Iran on Friday both played down an apparent Israeli airstrike near a major airbase and nuclear sites in central Iran, signaling the two bitter enemies are ready to prevent their latest eruption of violence from escalating into a full-blown regional war. But the indecisive outcome of weeks of tension, which included an alleged Israeli airstrike that killed two Iranian generals, an unprecedented Iranian missile barrage on Israeli, and the apparent Israeli strike early Friday in the heart of Iran, did little to resolve the deeper grievances between the foes and left the door open to further fighting. It appears that we're closer than ever to a broad regional war, despite the fact that the international community will most likely make a great effort to de-escalate tensions, wrote Amos Harel, a military affairs commentator for Israeli daily Haaretz. Israel has long considered Iran to be its greatest enemy, citing the Islamic Republic for calls for Israel's destruction, its controversial nuclear program, and its support for hostile proxies across the Middle East. These tensions have risen since the Hamas and Islamic Jihad Iran-backed Palestinian groups attacked Israel on October 7th, sparking a devastating Israeli offensive in Gaza that has continued for more than 6 months. Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed proxy in Lebanon, immediately began striking Israeli targets, opening up tit-for-tat fighting along a second front, while Iranian-backed militants in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen also have fired missiles and drones in Israel. While Israel and Iran have waged a shadow war for years, they have largely avoided direct confrontations. That changed after April 1st airstrikes killed two Iranian generals at a diplomatic compound in Damascus, Syria. Iran responded with its first ever direct attack on Israel, launching over 300 missiles and attack drones last Saturday. Israel, working with U.S.-led international coalition, said it intercepted 99% of the incoming fire through a handful of missiles managed to land, though a handful of missiles managed to land, causing minor damage to an Israeli military base and wounding a young girl. In Friday's attack, Iranian state tensions said that the air defense batteries fired in several provinces over reports of drones in the air. Another military article, Ukraine and Israel aid advances in rare House vote. With rare bipartisan momentum, the House pushed ahead Friday on a foreign aid package of $95 billion for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and humanitarian support, as a robust coalition of lawmakers helped it clear a procedural hurdle to reach final votes this weekend. Friday's vote produced a seldom-seen outcome that, in typically hyper-partisan House, with Democrats helping Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's plan advance overwhelmingly, 316-94. Final House approval could come this weekend, when the package would be sent to the Senate. It was a victory for the strategy Johnson set in motion this week after he agonized for 2 months over the legislation. Still, Johnson has had to spend several of the past 24 hours making the rounds on conservative media working to salvage support for the wartime funding, particularly for Ukraine as it faces a critical movement battling Russia, but also for his own job and the efforts to remove him as Speaker grows. Ukrainians desperately need lethal aid right now. We cannot allow Vladimir Putin to roll through another country and take it, Johnson told the conservative host of the Mark Levin show about Russian president's invasion of Ukraine. These are very serious matters with global implications. Johnson said after the vote that it wasn't perfect legislation, it was the best possible product Republicans can get, given their thin majority in the House. After months of delay, the House worked slowly but deliberately once Johnson made up his mind this week to plow ahead with a package that matches with a few alterations what the Senate passed in February. President Joe Biden sent a swift endorsement to the Speaker's plan, and in a rare moment, Donald Trump, the Republican presumed presidential nominee who opposes most aid for Ukraine, has not derailed the Speaker's work. In a rare step, the members of the House Rules Committee joined forces late Thursday in a near-midnight vote, the four Democrats giving their support on the procedural step to push past the Republican majority's three hard-line holdouts to send the package to the House floor for the debate on a 9-3 vote. It was a moment unseen in recent House memory. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 20th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Corinne Nidle. Whether or not you know the game of golf or not, whether or not you live in Iowa or not, family, friends, and fans of the game of golf are mourning the loss of Corinne Corky Nidle to a form of dementia in a memory care facility at her adopted home of the Villages in Central Florida. To call Corky a good golfer is a gross understatement. She lived and breathed it. She taught it, she officiated it, and she won at it, a lot. But if you played any level of golf in Iowa from the 1950s through the 1990s, you likely knew Corky's name or saw her play or officiate at numerous tournaments. When we called the Iowa Women's Amateur Golf Association to inform them of her passing, the person who answered recognized the name right away. Corky was also an avid collector of golf memorabilia of all kinds, including golf balls signed by famous pros, and even a club autographed by the great Ben Hogan. Corky was even courted by the women who founded the LPGA to join the tour in the 1950s, but she declined. She was also very much a community-minded person, hosting radio show from her home on Ottumwa, Iowa's KBIZ radio, helping to manage Ottumwa's Civic Music Association, sharing a love for classical music and opera. She also taught classes at the Ottumwa Heights College and hosted activities at the Ottumwa Country Club. She was also a co-owner of Nidle's Nook, the corner store and later gift shop, The Cranny. Eventually, Corky moved to Cedar Rapids and opened a successfully ran her second Nooks and Cranny gift shop until she retired and moved to Florida at the age of 72. Corky is survived by her daughter, Kathy Nicholson, granddaughters Sarah and Jessica, great-granddaughters Maria of Columbus, Ohio, and lifetime friend, companion, and golfing partner Linda Frisch. Per her request, she has been cremated. In lieu of flowers, we ask that you donate in Corky's name to the following Iowa Golf Association at 1605 North Ankeny Boulevard Street, 210 Ankeny, Iowa, 50023. Tim Cookie Cook. Timothy Patrick Cook, a.k.a. Cookie, 63, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully at home on April 12, 2024, following a long battle with severe illness. He was born in Cedar Rapids in 1990 to Joe and Margaret Cook and attended St. Jude School before switching to Truman, Taft, and Jefferson High School, where he began known for protecting friends from bullies and refusing to let any boys date his sister Janice. He was involved in football and wrestling until being struck by a van at an intersection of Williams Boulevard and 10th Avenue while walking home from a practice. Tim was hospitalized for almost a year, but then managed to graduate with his class. Though walking with a cane, Tim devoted himself to recovery, including surgeries, with the assistance of Senator Grassley. Tim was accepted into the U.S. Marine Corps in 1978, where he excelled as a sharpshooter and carried out special missions through 1982. He then attended Kirkwood for law enforcement and subsequently worked as a police officer in Belle Plaine. Back in the day, he would wear his Santa costume in duty, handing out lumps of coal on Christmas, and if you ever saw Santa on a Harley, that was Tim. Following his service, he worked for Amana Refrigeration and General Mills, where he became a union steward. Tim remained an avid marksman and enjoyed range shooting, hunting, ice fishing, and camping. He also bred dogs for several years and had a great attachment to animals. He loved road trips and was an avid foodie, including cooking. Tim will be remembered for his broad sense of humor. He always had jokes and one-liners at the ready. Think Norm from Cheers outside of a bar. His memory will live on in the hearts of all who loved him. Tim was preceded in death by his parents Joe and Margaret Cook, many aunts and uncles, and his beloved pets. He is survived by his son Nolan Cook of Cedar Rapids, former wife Anna Carolan of Cedar Rapids, and stepson Justin Carolan of Ames. Sister Jennifer Sancott and Bella Plain, Janice Cook Granforth of Iowa City, Joe Cook, several nephews and one niece, and his great-aunt Martha Evans of Cedar Rapids, and his snuggly cat Zoe. A celebration of life with military honors will be held at Prairie Oak Lodge at Wantanee Park, Marion, Iowa, on April 26th at 5 p.m. The family wishes to thank the members of his medical team for their care and support of Tim during his illness. Cynthia Fay Buck. Cynthia Fay Buck, age 88, of Clarence, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, surrounded by her children at the Clarence Nursing Home. A memorial service will be held at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence, with Jeanette Shotwell officiating on Friday, April 26th at 2:30 p.m. Visitation will occur at the church starting at 1 p.m. and will continue until the service begins. Interment will be at Loudon Cemetery. Cindy was born on March 24th, 1936, in Moorhead, Minnesota, to Oris and Olive Olesgard. She married Kenneth Derricks in 1956, to which her three children were born. She was married to Roland Buck in December of 1982, and he passed away in 2018. Survivors include her children, Barry and Susie Derricks of Solon, Pamela DeShaters of Joliet, Illinois, and Suzanne and Rick Klatt of Coralville, grandchildren Stacy and Justin Hunter, Ryan Klatt, Megan Klatt, and Kelsey Derricks, and great-grandchildren Emerson and Jackson. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband Roland, granddaughter Erin, and sister Sharon Engel. Cindy was an elementary school teacher in Clarence Loudon and North Cedar School districts for 32 years before retiring. She was an active member in St. John's congregation, participating in the church choir, the bell choir, and the lend a hand. Cindy cherished spending time with her family and was a regular attendee of her grandchildren's and great-grandchildren's many activities. As an avid fan of the Iowa Hawkeyes, she watched and attended many University of Iowa athletic events. Cindy loved reading, playing cards with family and friends, participating in golf and bowling leagues, gardening, shopping, and traveling. Chapman Funeral Home has Cindy and her family in their care. Memories and condolences may be left at www.chapmanfh.com. In lieu of flowers, the family requests consideration of a donation to the Clarence Public Library or the Parkinson's Foundation. Now let's move on to the sports section, starting with Lee, Gilman, Welker, and Laramendi still alive. A decade after winning his first age group world title in 2014, and 3 years after injury sidelined his Olympic dreams, which had been delayed a year earlier by the pandemic, former Hawkeye standout and three-time NCAA champion Spencer Lee opened his Olympic trials debut Friday with a solid 8-0 win. With a pair of takedowns and gut wrenches, Lee propelled himself to the semis in a loaded 57-kilogram bracket, where going into the event session, he was set to face number one seed former University of Illinois wrestler Zane Richards, a 2023 national champion and Pan American Games gold medalist. On the other half of Lee's bracket was fellow former Hawkeye Thomas Gilman, who likely had a first-round bye but then had to beat high school phenom Jax Forrest to get into his semifinals match. With more than a decade's difference between them, the 17-year-old high school sophomore at one point took the lead on Gilman, who responded with a takedown in the second to win 5-4. Lee and Gilman were among a crop of 14 Olympic hopefuls with past, present, or professional University of Iowa ties who traveled to Penn State's campus this weekend for a shot at competing in the Summer Olympics in Paris. Other Hawkeye-affiliated men competing in one of the six freestyle weights were four-time Big Ten champion Alex Marinelli and four-time All-American Tony Cassiope, both of whom wrapped their U of I wrestling careers in 2023. Although Cassiope went 0-2 in the tournament, Marinelli last night was battling back-for-back on the national team, affording him other benefits and opportunities, albeit not the Olympic team, after losing his second bout to second-seeded Jason Nolf, a three-time NCAA champion for Penn State. Marinelli picked up an 11-7 win over Penn State sophomore Levi Haynes, propelling him forward on the backside of the bracket. The Hawkeye women, like those on the men's side, had two wrestlers in the semifinals of the challenge portion of the tournament Friday. Winners of many Friday's 18 challenge bracket have to wrestle a best two of three championship series on Saturday against athletes already qualified for the finals through previous placement. The women representing the Hawkeyes last night's semis were Kylie Welker, who beat teammate Marilyn Deed 10-0 in the quarters, and Reese Laramendi, who last weekend won the U20 national champion and spot on the world team. With only six Olympic weights as opposed to the 10 collegiate classes, several Hawkeye women found themselves battling teammates in Friday's challenge tournament. First-year sophomore Nyla Valencia beat fellow sophomore Ava Bayless, who won the national championship in March. After losing her next match, Valencia dropped out of the tournament due to injury, giving the win to her teammate Amelia Gonzalez, who dropped her first match. Brianna Gonzalez and Felicity Taylor lost their first bouts in the 53-kilogram bracket, pitting them against one another on the other backside for the evening session. In Greco, although UNI resident Dr. Brandon Marshall lost his first match to number one seed, he remained alive on the backside of the bracket going into the evening. Now on to a football article. Iowa often set for debut, but don't expect the full picture today at Kinnick. The Iowa football will be in the public eye again at the Hawkeyes host their annual spring open practice today at Kinnick Stadium. Any talk about today's practice comes with an asterisk. What media and fans alike see representing an overall small sample size, it is one of 15 spring practices, with many more to come during the fall camp. It is a sample that takes place while quarterback Cade McNamara continues to recover from knee surgery. He has done some individual drills, but Deacon Hill has taken over the bulk of QB1 reps during 11-on-11 drills. Here are five questions that today and what happens in the subsequent days could help answer. Lester's offense. There's been a lot of talk about what Tim Lester's offense has looked like in the practices behind closed doors, or more like closed outdoor practice games, run-pass options, pre-snap motions, confusion, or consternation for the defense, depending on who you ask. Today will be the first extended look for the public at the Lester-led offense. There might be more to glean from scheme than execution. Between various spring injuries and possibly future transfer portal movement, the personnel running Lester's offense in April likely will vary from what fans see on Saturday in September. Lester said this week he has been calling offensive plays as if Cade were in there. That does not necessarily mean the results will be Cade-escade when Deacon Hill or Marco Lyons is running the offense. Defensive depth. With 10 players returning who have started 3 or more games in a Hawkeye uniform, and 8 with 10-plus starts, Iowa's defense returns a plethora of experience. All but 2 of the 10 of those 10 players are seniors or graduate students, so Iowa's second and third teams could give a glimpse of what the defense could look like in 2025 and beyond. The defensive line could be especially of interest, considering how much depth the position group regularly uses. Iowa has two starters returning, and four returning players took 100-plus snaps last year. This spring could go a long way in helping the Hawkeyes further develop and identify this year's 7th, 8th, and 9th guys in the defensive line rotation. Another subheader, first Rees-Dakin punt. It might be fair to have the same expectation for Rees-Dakin, Iowa's next Australian punter, but as there were for his predecessor, Torrey Taylor, Dakin and Taylor, Iowa special teams coordinator LeVar Woods say they are very different. A lot of similarities going to try and put them because they're both from Australia, Woods said this week. They're both from Melbourne. They both come from the same coach. They're very different. So what we've seen so far with Dakin is he's a very talented young man, but he's also young and green. Another subheader. Who's healthy? Offensive lineman Logan Jones said Gennings Dunker and defensive back Jeremiah Harris highlight the list of players already known to be missing spring practices. Last year's Kids Day open practice also serves as a reminder of the importance of getting through Saturday without any additional injuries. That was when McNamara suffered his quad injury, which lingered into the start of his injury-shortened 2023 season. Final subheader is What Happens Next? The transfer portal is open. Wide receiver Jacob Bostic caught some people on Evancheski Drive by surprise when he entered the portal on Tuesday. It may be advantageous for others to wait until spring practices are over. More practices mean more film to show to join him in the portal. At the same time, Iowa could potentially be in the shoppers in the transfer portal, particularly for a quarterback or wide receiver if the right opportunity presents itself. Now on to a similar article, this time for the Cyclones. Cyclones set to hype the future in spring scrimmage. The bumps and bruises are widespread, competition remains fierce. Even though Iowa State's spring football game at 11 a.m. today at Jack Trice Stadium isn't actually a contest of any sort, fans should grab a post-tailgate popcorn because there are plenty of things to watch. We are dinged up, said Cyclone head coach Matt Campbell, whose team is coming off its 6th winning season in the past 7 years. We've got ankles and shoulders and stuff, but in reality, the reality of it is we'll get a really good bit of work in Saturday. We're not going to waste any opportunity to have a great crowd or waste away a chance to evaluate our football team. So you're going to see live football. You'll see us scrimmaging. As for a format, forget about it. And players, it's an exhibition slash practice. So some of the headliners, such as Rocco Becht and tailback Abu Sama, may see light duty on the field, but spring games are designed to hype the future, which appears bright in terms of depth for ISU team that returns 19 starters. I think the biggest thing to watch our football team continue to grow, Campbell said. That growth serves as a reason, number 1 of 5, to watch today's game, and here are 4 more things to scrutinize as the Cyclones prepare to enter summer workouts. Number 1 is Rocco's the guy. Rocco Becht emerged from the fog last fall after former starting quarterback Hunter Deckers became entangled in the state's thorny investigation into sports gambling among college athletes at select institutions, and shined so brightly he earned Big 12 Offensive Freshman of the Year's honors. Beck threw 23 touchdown passes to just 8 interceptions last season, and his accuracy and decision-making prowess should be on display today for at least a part of the event. He's growing very single day in everything he does, which is super positive. New quarterbacks coach Jake Waters said, I keep talking to him about his process and what's going to take him to the next level. Next subheader is Ballyhooded Backups. Former 4-star recruit J.J. Cole has been awesome this spring as Beck's backup, Waters said. But gifted incoming freshman Connor Mowbray has been extremely impressive as well. Cole stands a towering 6'7" and weighs 250 pounds and boasts elite arm talent. He pressed Bex hard for the starting spot through fall camp last season, adding Morbury's athleticism helped make him more most important position on any team, deep one for the Cyclones. Really impressed with what they can do, and I'm fortunate to be able to coach them, said Waters, former Kansas State star. Another subheader is disruptive defensive line. The Cyclones returned experience on the defensive line, both on the edge and on the interior, but the younger players are helping to make position group a strength for the team, as usual. Redshirt freshman tackle Zaymar Hawk has an impressive offseason, as have ends Ikenna Izohu and Samuel Same. Sprinkle in Louisiana Monroe transfer Kennard Snyder on the edge, and ISU looks to be strong up front, the tackle on the defense side, with the ball on the defensive side of the ball will into the three deep. He's that guy on the fast side, Cyclone defensive line coach Eli Rashid said of Snyder. Final subheader, fast track at RB. Sama and Carson Hansen shined at times last season as freshman tailbacks, but fans should also keep an eye on the current true freshman Dylan Lee in the backfield. The 6'1", 200-pounder set a single-game Class 6A Arizona rushing record at high school junior, amassing an eye-popping 518 yards on the ground on 27 carries, and boasts a complete skill set that will be on full display today. He may be the strongest running back in that room from just a weight room standpoint, first-year assistant head coach and running backs coach Tyler Royal said. He's got raw ability. Seems Michigan's also having a spring game. Move on to the article. Michigan's Moore might show off QB options in spring game. Sharon Moore will have a lot of big decisions to make in his first season as Michigan's head coach, leading the defending national champions after Jim Harbaugh bolted to coach the Los Angeles Chargers. Who he chooses to start as quarterback will be a closely watched issue this season. Moore has a lot of options, including the speedy Alex Origi and experienced Jack Tuttle. Like a savvy coach, and not one in his first year, he dodged a question about whether the job could be shared. We'll see, he said with a grin. Fans will get their first look at Moore's choices under center when the Wolverines wrap up spring ball today at Michigan Stadium. J.J. McCarthy, who skipped his senior year to enter the NFL draft, led Michigan to its first national title since 1997 and third straight Big Ten crown. He leaves big cleats to fill. Origi, Tuttle, and Jaden Denegal each took snaps in 6 games last season, and Davis Warren appeared in 3 games, playing sparingly as a McCarthy backup. The 6'3", 236-pound Origi was used as a running threat at times last season, including in the national championship game where he had 2 carries for 15 yards and when he had 20-yard run to help the Wolverines beat rival Ohio State for a third straight year. Overall, he had 15 carries for 86 yards and a score. Obviously, a freak athlete, Moore said. Running the football is what he really has that is different element from the other guys, what we've seen in the past, but it's not like he can't throw. He can, and he's throwing pretty well. Who turns 25 this month has the most experience in the group. He is entering his 6th season of college football and 2nd year at Michigan after throwing passes in 4 seasons at Indiana. Uncle Jack, they call him, Moore said, a guy that's played a lot of football. He's got a great arm, great ability to run. He can be a dual-threat guy, but is also very cerebral in the pocket. While Origi did not attempt a pass last year, Tuttle was 15 of 17 for 130 yards with a touchdown. The 6-5 Denegal was 4 of 5 for 50 yards and a touchdown. Possibly more of a pocket passer, Moore said. The 6'2", 195-pound Warren didn't complete any of his 5 passes last season and had an interception. a little bit smaller in stature, but very cerebral with a good arm, Moore said. Jaden Davis, a four-star recruit, enrolled early as a freshman to help his adjustment to college on and off the field this spring. Very excited about him, Moore said. He picked up stuff super fast, but you never know with a freshman. We'll see if he has all the abilities. Michigan's quarterback will have added challenge of playing behind an offensive line without a returning starter. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, April 20th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.